We turn our attention now to Egypt, where protesters have occupied Cairo's Tahrir Square for the last 6 days. And joining us is Daniel Brumberg, senior advisor at the United States Institute of Peace and co-director of the Democracy and Governance Center at Georgetown. He recently wrote about the political problems facing post-Mubarak Egypt for the Atlantic magazine online, and we have a link to that on our show page at WMIC.org. Daniel, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
The Egyptian military, which has been running the country since Hosni Mubarak was toppled, announced yesterday that parliamentary elections will be pushed back from September to October or even November, and that the Ministry of Interior will fire nearly 600 police officers. Why are both of those moves significant to protesters who have been camping out again in Tahrir Square?
Well, you know, the military has, in a very general sense, a plan for where it wants to go. But within the broad parameters of that plan, it's really been improvising. And so every time the protesters push, the military gives just a little. Now, the concession on the elections is a victory, I think, for everybody, because it's inconceivable that Egypt would be prepared for parliamentary elections in September, which comes just after Ramadan. Even October may be too early to have a decent, fair, and credible election. So I think that is a concession that is a win-win for all participants. The firing.
But did the Islamist parties also want a delay in the elections?
Well, the Islamist parties would prefer to go ahead because they're the most prepared for elections, but they wouldn't necessarily oppose a postponement because they expect to do probably as well in September as in October or November. So I think that they'll probably go along with that. Other demands from the more secular parties they've rejected, but I imagine this one will not be unacceptable because everybody recognizes at the end of the day everybody, including the Islamists, benefit from an election that is well prepared and seen as legitimate. So I think on that score, it's okay.
Well, what percentage of the voters are expected to support the Islamist parties?
Well, nobody really knows. The polls suggest up to 40-50% at least of Egyptians don't know who they'll vote for. But I think that's a reasonable estimate to assume that at least 35% or 40%, perhaps more, of Egyptians will vote for the Islamist parties. How that comes out in terms of seats is another question, because we're still debating what kind of system they'll be using, a proportional or disproportional system. It'll probably be a mixed system. So the way in which the popular vote translates into seats is another matter. But I was also going to mention the other question you raised, which I think is important, and that is the decision to fire 600 or so mid-level police officers for actions taken in January, February against the students. And I think this is a concession to the students in Tahrir who have been demanding justice for the martyrs, as they're called, trials for the military involved in the clampdown. It's far from really what they're ultimately aiming for, but it is, from their perspective, a step probably in the right direction.
These are cops who are accused of gross misconduct, even killings during the protests.
That's right. And, of course, firing them hardly provides justice.
Because they won't be prosecuted.
They won't be prosecuted. The most telling figure I heard when I was in Egypt recently was that in the late 80s, mid-80s, there were 120,000 security forces. By 2010, there were 1.2 million, and they just preyed on the population. Now, of course, not 1.2 million security people were not involved in the repression of January and February, but the broader problem of how you deal with a security apparatus. It reminds me a bit of Iraq, how you sort of reintegrate this apparatus into the society, how you have justice, how you have whether you do or do not have trials. It's a huge and gigantic issue. But the mostly secular groups have fastened on this issue as a way of keeping the kind of Tahrir revolution as they see it alive, and I think as a way of keeping their own solidarity alive as well, because my sense is that if they didn't have this issue to grasp onto, particularly the secular forces might fragment even more than they already are.
But didn't de-Ba'athification backfire in Iraq?
It did, and I think that one has to be very careful on many fronts about how you go about making an argument for, or if you make an argument for excluding 1.whatever million security forces from political and social life. I mean, you have to be very wary of a backlash. Now, in Iraq, the problem was exacerbated by the fact that this was a Sunni-Shia split. It was a sectarian split. And happily, that's not the case in Egypt. It's more an economic and social question. But nevertheless, it's very significant. And apart from that, the other thing I heard very much in Egypt was growing concern, even from human rights activists, that the push for revenge against Mubarak and his family, the push for trials, was compromising the independence and integrity of the court system, which even under the authoritarian regime of Mubarak had maintained a certain credibility and independence. So there are many things at play here.
In the eyes of the protesters, does regime change mean the entire regime?
It really does. And there's an interesting sort of contradiction going on here. It's a good question. I mean, for the students, this is a revolution. But looking at it from outside in, and even somewhat inside in, this is really a transition. And it's partly it's a negotiated transition, partly it's an imposed transition. It reminds me of Brazil and Chile in the 80s. And in that sense, it's far from the revolution that these young people were expecting. And moreover, to the extent that many of the young people, not all, but many of them were more secular-oriented, they find themselves out-organized by the Islamists, particularly the Ikhwan Muslimin, the Muslim Brethren. And they're very frustrated about that because the Muslim Brethren have been very good at keeping their credibility with the population, yet not alienating the military. And they've played that game very well. And that's not something that the more secular students are able to do, nor do they want to do that.
Well, demonstrators in Cairo are also calling for the ouster of Zahi Hawass, Egypt's antiquities minister. So it even extends beyond the obvious politically powerful.
Well, he was friends with Suzanne Mubarak, the president's wife, who was seen as this is often the case in these sort of scenarios. We saw it in Tunisia, although Suzanne Mubarak was hardly as corrupt as the wife of Ben Ali. But she was identified with various projects and corruption and so on. The extent of these accusations are open to question, as well as these other accusations directed at other cronies of Mubarak. But this is, again, a way of keeping the flame lit, of trying to expunge the old regime. I think my own sense is that this may be something of a displacement of energies that all political forces, particularly the secular forces, who are really in the minority, have an interest in organizing and getting their act together for elections. But at the same time, they feel that the only way to keep their unity going and keep lighting or relighting the fire of mobilization is to focus on these issues of justice, the martyrs, corruption, and so on.
What's happened to the opposition leaders we heard so much about in the West during the first protests, people like Mohamed El-Baradei?
Well, Baradei is still in the game to the extent that he is still suggesting he will run for president, although he's been back and forth on that. Baradei's role has been to keep the issue of the constitution burning, and in Egypt, the new constitution will only be written after the elections. That really has upset the secular forces because they see if elections take place first and the Muslim Brethren win, they're afraid that the Islamists will write the constitution. Baradei's contribution to this debate has been to argue for a bill of rights, a set of principles, and just yesterday, the Supreme Military Council agreed to establish a committee that would sort of define a set of basic constitutional rights which could not be violated when finally a new constitution is created. This may be a useful step in the right direction, although you really never know exactly what the military is up to. So Baradei has to be credited and his allies for keeping this issue of the constitution alive and getting some concession from the military on that.
Meanwhile, the Muslim Brotherhood is expelling anyone who disagrees with the leadership.
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood has always been about two things, unity and discipline, and I think in many respects that's never changed. Political movements, by the way, even the ones that are proposed democracy, are hardly internally democratic. There's nothing unusual about that. But in this case, there's a certain convergence in terms of the Muslim Brotherhood's view of its own internal politics and external politics. It really drives for unity, for discipline, and it expelled Abdul Mondem Fattouh, a kind of liberal Islamic thinker who I interviewed when I was in Cairo, for insubordination and for not listening essentially to the orders and directives of the leadership of the Muslim Brethren. And this is also alienated, and I think this in some respects is a good part of the story, the kind of youth Muslim Brethren leaders who are really fed up with the old-time leaders of the Muslim Brethren who have been there for a long time, and they've created their own political party. So the actions of the Muslim Brotherhood have demonstrated the limits of their own tolerance for pluralism. And I think in some respects that's a useful thing.
My guest is Daniel Brumberg, senior advisor at the United States Institute of Peace, co-director of the Democracy and Governance Center at Georgetown, who's written recently about the political problems being faced in a post-Mubarak Egypt for the Atlantic magazine online. You compare the turmoil in Egypt right now to cars stuck in a traffic jam.
Well, you know, they're always searching for a metaphor. And the thing that struck me is I lived in Egypt for a long time. I was in a lot of traffic jams before, but not one in which there was any absence of police, the direct trafficker, to get people out of it. And here, one thing you notice in Egypt is the absence of police in a lot of places, which I think is not unintentional. I think that the police are sending a message to the young revolutionaries that, well, if, you know, you think you've prevailed and you want us off the streets, here's what you're going to pay for, which is traffic jams and much worse. And so it's sort of indicative in many ways of the moment.
What about the economy? Isn't it in a shambles?
It's in shambles. When I was staying at a very nice hotel, I was almost accosted by people, by tradesmen and so on, who were desperate to sell their art and their wares. Egypt's economy depends on tourism, and there is no tourism. The flight I took, in fact, from Paris to Cairo was almost empty. So it is a desperate situation in that regard. And it's hard to see this whole process moving forward without some revival of the economy. It's got to be kept in mind that apart from the Tahrir kind of protesters, there was 2 years of spontaneous protests within the labor movement from workers at every level who were very upset with living conditions and wages, and those issues remain absolutely critical to the protesters.
Well, in the Mubarak years, there were any number of actions by terrorists against tourists. It seems to me the situation might be better for tourists now than before.
Well, I suppose you could say that. I mean, absolute price-wise, I think I can assure you there's a great bargain there. The problem of terrorism and tourism has not been one that's been on, has been present for a long time. But it's interesting you should mention that the terrorism issue, the enlargement of the security forces, probably began when they first expanded to fight the issue of terrorism, and then suddenly developed a life of their own and started to sort of prey on the population. So there's an interesting link between the terrorism of 10 years ago and this spontaneous, huge growth of the security apparatus.
You write that the Egyptian military has two goals in domestic politics. What are they?
Well, I think the main goal is to protect their own interests. They're not only institutional as a military, but they have deep roots in the economy. And the other basic goal is to sort of rearrange the political field so the main economic and political players who were mostly there before are still there after the election, and that there's a high degree of stability and predictability. And that means that they are not going to back a process that fundamentally overturns or threatens the major significant political and economic elites who compromise the political and social system. They want a high degree of continuity in that regard.
Well, in a sense, hasn't the military been in charge of Egypt since Nasser seized power?
Yeah.
Nasser, Sadat, Mubarak were all military men.
Yeah.
But they represented different economic approaches, didn't they? Nasser was a socialist in name.
Yes, that's true. The military under the Mubarak period became very much sunk its claws into the economy, particularly part of the government-owned economy and businesses, and greatly resented the neo-orthodox economic reforms undertaken by Mubarak and the various elements of the business community, including his son. To some extent, you can see a settling of scores here by the military to the extent that they resented the way in which the population responded to this very haphazard economic reform project in the last decade, and then turned around and blamed not only the politicians but the military. They'd like to get out of that business of being blamed for that. The big difference now, of course, is the military is in charge directly in politics. In
20 generals.
20
much.
Generals. They are not only ruling, but they're governing. They would like to get out of the direct process of government so they can continue exercising influence on the sidelines as they did before. And I think that their desire to move as quickly towards elections is indicative of the fact that they can't stand the day-to-day tasks of economic political management. They're not cut out for that. They want the professional politicians to do that, to take the credit, and, of course, to take the blame for any problems.
Now, Daniel, we have very little time, and I hate to ask for predictions, but do you think that Egypt will become a full-fledged democracy?
Well, I think it's a 10 or 20-year project, and I think it's going to depend in part on how the Ikhwan Muslimin, Muslim Brethren, respond and behave after elections. Are they going to, one way or the other, they're going to win significant representation? And if they see this as simply an invitation to impose their own agenda on everyone else, I fear for the political system. If they can be compelled by real competition and maybe by sort of ultimately their own rational interests to step back from the brink and compromise, I think we can institutionalize a democratic process in the next in the successive election after that.
Daniel Brumberg, we have to end it there. Thank you so much for talking with us.